Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, October 8th. I'm Ray Graff. Time to talk some car maintenance and repair with Gordon Fricke. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive, an independent repair, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. If you have a question about your vehicle, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Gordon is an extremely popular guest. We like to get to as many people as we can. If you have a question, call early, 800-348-2551, or email voxpop@wamc.org. Gordon Fricke and your car calls, coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On the program again today to answer your automotive maintenance and repair questions is Gordon Fricke, owner and operator of Barber and Fricke Automotive, an independent repair, towing, and used car facility in Hoosick Falls, New York. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for more than 30 years. Starting out in Germany, I believe. Gordon Fricke is a great guest on this program and a popular one. I suggest you call while there are a few open lines. We'll try to get to you. 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. That's the number on Vox Pop. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Gordon Fricke, welcome back. How are you, sir?
Hello, Ray. Thank you. Good to be back.
How are things at the new shop?
Well, you know, we're doing quite well. I'm trying to get accustomed to a much smaller space. You haven't seen the new digs, but you remember the old place,
sure,
right?
Sure do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I went from the Titanic into one of the lifeboats, practically.
Well, come on. The old place wasn't the Titanic. It was very nice.
Yeah, no, but it was big. It was big, yeah.
So you're finding that...
You're finding
the new space is enough for what you got to do?
No, but I'm going to make it work.
All right, fair enough.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for sparing us an hour here. I know you're pretty busy, but thanks for that. And, you know, over the phone, Gordon Fricke is pretty darn good with me. Well, we got a stack of emails here, and the phone lines are loading up. So I'll give you an email question that came in yesterday at this time. This is from Mary in Rensselaerville, who says, I'm the original owner of a 2011 Mercedes-Benz GLK 350, 140,000 miles. The car has been relatively maintenance-free and a dream to own. Recently, however, I noticed a thumping noise coming from underneath the midsection on the back of the car when driving up a hill or incline, with the RPM gauge registering between 1.5 and 2-ish, and at speeds between 40 and 60, regardless of road surface. There is no thumping noise going downhill or on straightaways. I took the car into my generally capable mechanic. He found nothing wrong. Any thoughts about what's going on there? And that's from Mary in Rensselaerville.
Yeah, so this is a, I'm pretty certain this is a 4MATIC, which is Mercedes-Benz talk for all-wheel drive.
Yeah.
And it's possible, given that mileage and the age, that there might be a concern with the drive shaft, which with one of the joints possibly in the drive shaft.
Right.
And you'll only feel that when you're under a bit of a load, like going up a hill. And a lot of drivetrain concerns that are hard to diagnose will only surface when you're on a hill or accelerating. Once you ease up on the throttle, the load is reduced, and whatever is marginally starting to either fail or wear kind of goes away. So I guess my thought would be really zoom in on the drive shaft from the transmission back to the differential, and also the condition of the rear drive axles and their protective boots, the CV boots, because there could be something going on back there with a drive axle.
Interesting.
So, you know, when you have a 4MATIC or an all-wheel drive car, there's quite a few moving parts.
So the drive shaft, I mean, can you diagnose? Can you put it on a lift and diagnose it just by looking at it?
Well, you can do a couple things. You can, with a helper in the vehicle, you can very carefully speed the vehicle up on the lip. So the wheels are all hanging on the ground. The ABS braking system is going to try to intervene. But you can watch things turn. You're not going to simulate the load because you're not on a dyno. You're just hanging in the shop. But
right.
That might spot a torn boot on a CV drive axle, and or you may spot a universal joint or another type of a joint that Mercedes-Benz uses, these flex couplers, of some fatigue and some wear. But that's where I'd start.
I imagine replacing a drive shaft would be not inexpensive.
It can be quite expensive. And the way a lot of these drive shafts are manufactured, and this is not just for that car, it's for many cars, BMW, Subaru, Toyota, the drive shaft, the front of your drive shaft, is generally serviced as a complete unit. So that really does mean, yes, Ray, expensive.
Okay. This one's from Tom in Gardner, Massachusetts. Subject heading, defogging. Once again, how do we defog the interior windshield? After 50-plus years, I still can't figure it out. And that's from Tom in Gardner.
Defog, in other words, how to set his heater, or what do you think he's talking about there?
I don't
know.
Defog the interior part of the windshield. I'm not sure exactly. Yeah. I mean, you turn the defroster on, yeah?
Yeah. Well, so what I've discovered is if the inside of the windshield and the other windows, for that matter, are not clean, they will fog way easier than when they are clean. I mean, glass cleaner and paper towels or whatever.
Yeah.
But the heating system on most cars today, when I say most cars, everything that's equipped with an integrated AC, which is 99.9% of everything. When you select the defroster, it's turning on the air conditioner, even in the middle of the winter. And what it's there for is to dehumidify the air that's then blasted onto the glass to prevent fogging.
Interesting.
He could have a deficiency with the AC in his car. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe it hasn't worked in 2 years. But that will affect the ability to defog the windows, and it'll affect it pretty greatly.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, it may not be much of a thing anymore, but in the old days, you could get cars without air conditioning. How'd you defrost then?
Just took longer, because you were relying on just the air going through your heater and hitting the glass. It wasn't ever dehumidified, so it did take longer in those days.
Gordon Fricke's our guest. It's Automotive Maintenance and Repair today. And I know you and I talked about this within the last few years. We've done so many shows. But the rear defrost has the wires in the glass, and it's very, very fast to de-ice a windshield, the back windshield.
Yeah.
Why don't they have that in the front windshield again?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because there's a company that's known as Land Rover, and they had, or I don't know if they have them currently, but for many, many years, they had those same little teeny wires in the front windshield.
Yeah.
And they were so small that they did not affect your vision driving the vehicle.
Right.
But as you got your eyes closer to the windshield, you'd see them. And they are just as fast and effective as the heated glass, the rear glass on cars. Why don't a lot of cars have it? I got a feeling it's expense. I think it's a really expensive windshield.
Yeah.
And you've got the, the wiring and the controls that operate it. But I've driven Land Rovers with that heated windshield, and it's very quick to defrost. It's very good.
Very interesting. I mean, my theory was, at least for a time, the antennas were in the windshield for radio. And so I thought maybe that would cause RF interference with the antenna. But then I realized, going back to the 70s and earlier than that, the old-fashioned antennas were outside the car. So that kind of shot that theory out of the water.
In today's world, Ray, I don't think very few who listens to AM radio? I know you're going to get people that say, well, of course I do. But Ford made a statement last fall, that they were going to discontinue the AM feature in the radios of all of their cars.
They can't.
And there was an uproar. They said, no, you can't. It has to do with public broadcasting and emergency signals that you know better than I do, Ray. Do they travel faster and better? What's the advantage to AM in that case?
They don't travel faster, but you will get longer. So FM, VHF, that's in the VHF band, it's line of sight. Basically, if I'm behind a mountain, I won't pick up that signal. But AM radio will, there are different propagations at play, and it can go potentially a much greater distance and also be a little less susceptible to interference like that.
So when we were younger, much younger, we would scan the AM dial, and we'd pick up radio stations from hundreds of miles away, right?
Oh, heck yes. I remember as a kid, I used to listen to Dan Ingram in the afternoon on WABC on 77, and it would come in very nicely. It was pretty.
Yeah.
Oh, memories. Let's take a break, Gordon, and we'll get back to the phones here. 800-348-2551. That's the number if you have a question for Gordon Fricke. We'll be back. Cyrus Chestnut, you ain't nothing but a hound dog here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is our number. Gordon Fricke is our guest. At to the phones we go. Amy is in Queensbury. Amy, you're up.
Hey, Gordon, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Last week, I was driving my car. I drive a 2013 Hyundai Sonata, and it just completely shut off. Getting off the off-ramp off the Northway. I pulled over, put the car in park, it started up again, but it shut off again. But the next time I started it, I got it to Napa, and it turned out that I was completely at ground zero on my oil level, but my oil indicator light never came on. I'm wondering, and my mechanic cannot get me in until the 25th. They put almost a gallon of oil in my car. I'm wondering, is it safe to drive until I can get to my mechanic?
Well, if you were critically low but not completely empty, it may not have turned the warning light on. Now, the warning light is pretty flimsy, because your car does not have a level light. In other words, where it says add 1 quart of oil, you're getting low. Your car simply has the red light of death, that if you drive
Correct.
With the oil light on for any period of time, it usually wipes the engine out. So did you get towed to the facility?
No, I actually drove to Napa, and then they scanned all the lights on my dashboard came on. They scanned my engine. The alternator is fine. Battery's fine. The starter is fine. But they put the gallon of oil in, and now my engine light is still flashing.
Which, the check engine light?
Yes, the oil light never came on.
So does the engine sound noisier than previously, or does it sound okay and drive okay?
It sounds okay and it drives okay, but I'm afraid of it shutting down again.
Yeah. Well, you may not have been, I mean, a gallon of oil is about it for that car. Might have had, maybe had a touch more left in it, but here's a quick test. Does that car have a key or a push button start?
A key.
Okay, so turn the key on, but don't start the engine. But turn it on enough so all your warning lights light up.
Okay.
And see if the red oil light lights up. That's its test. That's why all these lights come on before you start the engine. If the oil light lights up, and it's going to be red, and then after you start the engine, in a few seconds it goes out, the oil pressure is adequate for that switch or that sensor in your particular car. But if you've got a check engine light flashing, you may have an entirely different concern there, because a flashing check engine light usually means it's not going to run well. So my advice is to not drive the car until you can get it more thoroughly diagnosed. Because, you, like you said, you don't want to be stuck again. This time you won't be on the off-ramp. You'll be on the interstate, right?
Right, right, right.
So I don't like if it's the check engine light and it's flashing. That's indicating an engine misfire or something that's causing the engine not to run properly.
Yeah.
And that could definitely lead to another failure or breakdown.
All right, Amy, thanks a lot for the call. It's Gordon Fricke today, 800-348-2551. Our friend Ted in Shelburne, Vermont is on. Ted, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoy this show, and I almost prefer to be a spectator, but this 09 Pontiac Vibe, it's the 2.4 engine, and it's only front-wheel drive. It's not the all-wheel drive, which I know can be more problematic with brakes. And I just had a trusted one-man shop do brakes, and I think we did calipers and everything on the rear within the last year, and within the last month we did the front calipers and whole deal. And he took it out just to check it over when he was done, and the left front was hot when he came back. Mm. And he figured, well, probably a bad caliper, and he ordered up another one, and it came, and he put it on, and it's better, but it still has some drag. And the one question is, like, I just drove it, you know, a few miles, and it's all right on errands, but you can feel it subtly not free rolling as you come in neutral to a stoplight or something.
Right.
And it's warmer than the others. And when I left his shop the first time, it's some distance from here, you know, it was really hot after, or, you know, I felt it was seriously hot after 15 or so miles, some of which, you know, mostly just moving right along.
Right.
He suggested, you know, I mean, I did go back, and he said, maybe it's the hose. As I say, it's an 09. It only has a little over 100,000 miles.
Right.
It's generally...
Did he replace the hose?
He didn't replace the hose yet. I mean, that was sort of the end of our session that day.
Right.
And it's been a week or so, and it's some distance to his shop, and I'm wondering if I might even treat it separately. And in the old days, I'd have done it. I think I could bleed the brakes all right if they're not more complicated than the old days, just to do both of those hoses, or have someone do it, you know, take it back and have him do it. But it still
the
is
hose
needing attention.
Is,
like, if I were to head out for a serious 40-50 miles, I think I'd feel it being very hot.
Right. The hose is definitely a suspect here, and it's pretty easy to diagnose if it's a imploding or a internally collapsing hose. And what we do is we'll put the car on the lift and have access to the bleeder. Sometimes you have to take the wheels off, other times you don't. But you have a helper in the vehicle, and he puts the brakes on quite hard, and then releases the brake pedal, and you see which wheel is hard to turn, and you immediately brake that bleeder free. And if that bleeder gives a little squirt, and that wheel is now free as the others, you have 99% isolated the hose to that one wheel.
The hose, because there's no backflow in the hose. Okay.
Right. Yep.
All right, Ted. Now, go ahead, Gordon.
Just one real quick thing. I know we've taken a lot of time. Extreme cases, you could have a problem in the ABS unit that's backing that fluid up, and that requires more testing and cracking lines. It can be very time-consuming, but I would be very suspicious of the hose, and that's a really easy way to test it.
Gordon Fricke's our guest today, automotive maintenance and repair for the month of October. And let's go to Hoosick Falls. Uh-oh, you probably know this guy. It's John in Hoosick Falls. You're talking to Gordon in Hoosick Falls. Go ahead.
Hi, Gordon. It's John.
Hey, John.
So my kit car, I took it out the other day, and so I backed it out in the driveway, and then I had to go back into the house. And it had been idling for probably 30 seconds, and I noticed antifreeze underneath the vehicle. So I put it back into the garage, and then I thought, well, let me see if I can simulate the problem. And in order to do that, it had to idle for probably 2 or 3 minutes, and then all of a sudden, coolant came shooting out of the overflow reservoir.
Right.
And
now does that car have a electric fan? I'm pretty sure it does, right? It's not an engine-driven cooling fan?
Correct.
Did you hear the fan running?
What was No, the fan was not running. But what was interesting was the temperature gauge just before the overflow occurred, you know, it seemed to be going up normally. And then all of a sudden it just went up very quickly to probably 180, 200 degrees. So I'm wondering, I looked up and it said it could be a bad thermostat or a bad water pump. And
it's more likely the thermostat, because that engine has a pretty old school water pump, belt driven. And unless when they did that engine, unless that's got a plastic impeller on the water pump, water pumps usually don't just stop pumping unless the impeller fails. And it's usually with a plastic impeller on a metal shaft, and they'll fail without any warning. And you don't know if you've got a plastic impeller pump really until you take it off the engine. But I don't think they were using those. That's a 302 in there. The engine.
Yeah, is that 5 liter?
Yeah, 5 liter. Yeah. So I would be very suspicious of a thermostat, because that will stick and you can get a very rapid overheat. And or depending on where your cooling fans are set, but you know, at a certain time that fan needs to be coming on, and if that fails to come on, you know, same situation. You'll get too hot, it'll overpressure and push it past that overflow.
All right.
So coolant level, fans coming on, and thermostat. I'd be concerned about those things.
What kind of kit was that, Gordon? Do you remember?
It's a Cobra.
Oh, cool.
A Cobra with a Fox body donor engine and transmission, John?
Oh, he's gone now. But I'll tell you one thing. John in Hoosick Falls sure saved himself your hourly, because he's right in the same town as you, and he called you on the show. He could have walked over.
I can see his house from my house across the valley.
All right, he was born to save a buck, that guy. All right, let's go to Pittsfield. Bobby, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hey, Ray.
Hey.
Hi, Gordon.
Hi.
Hey, I've got a battery tender on my car when I just want to keep the battery up, okay? In this new car, I can't really access the battery because it's underneath and it's new to me. And I was wondering, can you hook up the battery tender to the alternator and ground it to the alternator and charge the battery that way?
Yeah, so a battery tender, which is providing pretty low amperage, doesn't have to necessarily be directly on the battery. But you want to be on a big source. So what kind of car is it?
Well, it's a 4-0 Ford with a Chevy motor, okay? It's got, I'm not exactly sure, but it's got the alternator. You know, it's modified, and the battery's underneath, and it's got a good alternator source, so I thought I could hook it up to the alternator and ground it to the alternator and juice it that way.
Yeah, you can take the positive part of that tender and hook it on the big fat wire of the alternator, the wire that does that sends the current to the battery, the big red wire.
You bet.
The ground wire can go to any ground source on the vehicle. It doesn't have to go to the alternator. It can go to the engine block. It can go to the chassis. It just needs to make a good ground connection somewhere. And that's how you can hook that tender up.
Oh, good. Geez, yeah, because it's tough to get to underneath the car, blah, blah, blah. Hey, thanks for the information, Gordon. You're great.
Sure.
All right, Bobby, thanks for the call. So those old cars, as I recall from my 65 from way back when, that had a generator. And Bobby said they swapped it out and put an alternator in. Does that require a lot of work to change that whole system over?
No, not really. There's a lot of alternator conversions available for older cars. They're super easy. AC Delco, the go-to alternator used to be what they call a single-wire AC Delco alternator.
Yeah.
And it's simple. It's really one wire.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. And the batteries on those old vehicles, were they 6-volt in the old days?
Well, they were up until a certain point. Like your Le Mans was 12-volt.
Yeah, oh, for sure, yeah.
The U.S. went to brought them up to 12 volts before a lot of the European cars did. But, 6 volts, you know, you go back into the 50s,
yep.
Probably get some 6 volts and further beyond that for sure.
Gordon Fricke's our guest today. It's car repair and maintenance. And let's grab another call or two before the next break. 800-348-2551 is our number. In Richmond, Massachusetts, there's a person named Pam. Pam, you're on.
Thank you. Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
I have a GMC 2016 Acadia, and it does this odd thing only on one right turn. It's the right turn when I'm coming home, and when I make this right turn, there's a dip in the road before it levels out again. But what happens is I go to accelerate again, and the transmission is not engaged. And what usually would happen is, you know, after a couple of minutes, it would go back into the transmission would start to work and I'd drive off. But what I'm finding now is that I can coast probably like a tenth of a mile before the transmission engages again. Or sometimes I even try and click it down into a lower gear to get the transmission. I don't know what's happening, but it's only this one turn on this one road, only a right-hand turn, only this, that, no other place does this happen. I was wondering if it's a dip in the road.
Is it a pretty long turn? Are you turning right for quite a ways at that point?
No, it's an immediate right hand turn, like a 90-degree. But it's
okay.
It's a quick one.
Okay,
a quick dip.
Go ahead, Gordon.
Probably what you've got happening there is your fluid is too low. And when you do that 90-degree turn, and you may be going at some speed. The fluid, just picture yourself, running with a pot of water. And when you do a sharp change in direction, that water tries to go up the side of that pot. And that's exactly what's happening inside of your transmission. I think your fluid's low and your transmission's losing its fluid momentarily. And on that particular vehicle, I believe there is no dipstick, so you have to get it checked at a facility or a repair shop where it goes up on a lift level and then the technician checks it from below. But I would do that soon, because if you're low, that transmission is not going to be happy about it and it could get very costly.
Pam.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I tell you what, that's a good spot to take a break. Gordon Fricke's our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll check the email bag in a moment. That's The Slide Down by a group called The Skinny here on Vox Pop. Hey, thanks, everybody. Good job this morning. We appreciate all your pledges during the lockbox portion of our fun drive. You can do it right now at WAMC.org. If you like the Gordon Fricke program once a month and you value some of the stuff you hear, doesn't have to be everything, a little pledge is helpful. $5, $10, $100, whatever you got. And you can go to WAMC.org. to do that. And once again, thank you if you've already kicked in the kitty. It's Vox Pop, and the aforementioned Gordon Fricke's our guest. Gordon, let's do a couple emails here before we head back to the phones for the home stretch. This one's from Henry.
All right.
Henry writes, with the winter season, thank you for bringing it up, Henry. With the winter season around the corner, what are some good things to keep in the car? I usually keep some cat litter in the event that car tires need traction, blanket, ice scraper. But are there things I should add to that list? That's from Henry.
Well, I think it's always a good idea to have a set of jumper cables in the car.
Yeah.
Because if you let's say you get stuck and your battery is weak or you left something on, there are a ton of people that would offer to jumpstart your car, but none of them may have cables. If you've got the cables, I think it's easy to flag somebody down. I would add that to the list.
Yeah.
Other than the items that Henry just spoke about, that's probably really it.
Maybe a week's worth of canned soup. That would be nice, right?
Yeah, and a little Sterno thing to heat it up with. You could have a nice hot meal in the car, you know.
Yes, Gordon, yes, and maybe a tent. And there'll be no room left for any passengers, so it'll work out well. This is from
right.
D. An old car is the subject heading. I have a 2006 Infiniti sedan built like a tank. I've invested a lot of money to keep it running, including a rebuilt engine. Alas, it is no longer running, and I'm done with trying. Is there any way to recoup some of the money I put into it? Can I sell the catalytic converter? I read that may be something. What about the rest of the vehicle? How do I go about this? And that's from D.
Yeah. What you can do is call around. Some of the larger salvage companies that sell used car parts, basically, will also buy your old car. I don't know what they'll pay for it. The thing to do would be to reach out to some of the larger used auto parts facilities. There's lots of them out there. You can just go on the internet and see who's nearby and ask that question. Say, this is the vehicle. It does have a remanufactured or rebuilt engine. The car's getting a little older where the demand may not be that high for its parts, but
yeah.
There is some value still in it, and there is salvage value, like the caller or the emailer was saying. The catalytic converter has value. So, yeah, there's something to get out of it.
I mean, not for nothing. We used to do this, and I think we still do. You can donate your car to WAMC. You won't get cash, but you get a tax deduction out of that, and I don't know all the details.
I do remember that. Yeah, I remember that program, and what would it hurt to say, what kind of a deduction do I get? You know, do they value the car? Do they say, okay, you're going to get a $1,200, tax deduction, and then if you go to your accountant, you might get $10 off of your, you're not going to get all that money off your taxes, but look at it and see, you know?
I hear you, man. Well, I don't know exactly how it works, but I know it was something we have done. I'm pretty sure we still do it. You can always call our front office and find out more about that.
Yeah.
Jay says, when I apply the brakes on the highway at 50 miles per hour or more, I get a shaking as long as my foot's on the brake. Doesn't seem to happen at lower speeds. Is this brakes or wheel balance or something else?
Yeah, no, it's classic brake rotors or discs.
Yeah.
Same thing, two different terms. And they will warp or give you that feedback for a couple of reasons. They will sometimes get so rusty that the blotches of rust or the imperfections in those rotor surfaces will vibrate back through the braking system and hit you in the pedal. You'll feel it in your foot.
Right.
The rotors can also be warped from age, from all the heat cycling. You know, the 10 million times they've stopped the car, they just can't stand the heat anymore, and they warp. And a kind of a good way to tell if it's front or rears is if you're on the brakes and you're getting those symptoms, if it's shaking the steering wheel significantly, that is definitely the front rotors causing it.
Oh.
But it doesn't mean that the rears aren't doing their share of giving you feedback also. But when it jiggles the wheel, you definitely have a front issue.
You know, I had the brakes done on the Caddy not too long ago, and is it not a thing anymore that you can just get the pads done? You got to get the rotors too?
The rotors have become completely disposable items because the quality of the rotor has decreased in terms of the metal,
yeah,
the the origin of 99% of those components tend to be from overseas suppliers that may not have the strictest quality control.
Aye.
And the choice of metals, right? You've had stuff that's been recycled 100 times, and the metal is just not great. So by the time you machine them, you'll find out that they're too thin to reuse and you got to throw them away, or cost, you know, as much as one rotor to machine two of them. So you just replace them, and that's the way it's become now, basically.
All right, let's go back to our phone lines. Gordon Fricke's our guest today. We go to Kingston, and it's Amy's turn. Hello, Amy.
Yes, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, hi. Thank you for taking the call.
You bet.
I have a 2002 Honda Civic stick shift. And I got it 2 years ago and for $4,200, and it overheated and I wrecked the engine. They had to put another one in, and now I'm driving around the car and I'm just still getting very low gas mileage, maybe 20 miles to the gallon on the highway. Other than that, it is a clutch car, and I'm just wondering, is it worth it to try to have them diagnose it and fix the problem? People don't seem to want to do much. I don't know what to say about that one.
Yeah. Generally, the computer's in control of the fuel mixture. So is your check engine light on?
No. No.
Okay. Because if it was on, the reason it may be on would be because it's running too rich and using more gasoline. That Civic should get quite good gas mileage. Being a stick car, it's a very light vehicle. You know, the things that affect fuel economy are condition of the air filter, condition of the mass airflow sensor that measures how much air the engine is using, and that can be cleaned and or replaced. Ray's got some history of replacing those stupid things, right?
Yes.
Tire pressure and alignment has a lot to do with gas mileage. A bad alignment...
Yeah, I just fixed that. I got brand new tires and aligned everything. But even on the highway,
has your economy gotten any better, or haven't you had enough time to check it?
My economy? I don't get it.
Yeah, has your gas mileage improved since you got the tires and the alignment?
The car has power. It has a little kick to it. I put a new battery, aligned brand new tires. It passed inspection. But it still is underperforming. I mean, if I go from Kingston to New York City, which is what, 110 miles, you'll use half a tank.
Yeah. Well, I would be concerned with the other things then, the condition of the filters, spark plugs, engine condition, compression. Is the engine getting tired? You know, somebody's going to have to do a little bit more digging if you want to, you know, get more serious about why your gas mileage is poor. So state of tune, spark plugs, filters, and at that point, it's an unknown engine because they put a used engine in. It'd be nice to do a compression test to see how strong the engine still is.
Okay.
All right.
And that's what I would do to start with.
Amy, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Gordon Fricke from Barber and Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, New York, joins us today. He's got new digs, and he's just settling in. So if you're in Hoosick Falls, if you're looking for his other spot, it's not there. But Hoosick Falls isn't that big. You'll find it. 800-348-2551 is our number if you have a question in the waning moments here. Harlan in East Greenbush, go ahead. It's Harlan. Hey, Harlan.
Of course.
Oh, go ahead.
Of course, you guys catch me as I drop my phone.
That's right.
That's the way it works in my world. So question for Gordon. How many of these Hondas are you seeing now that have fuel injection issues? That's part one. Part two is the CVT crap. So I had fuel injection issues at $2,000. And a month later, I dropped my CVT transmission in god-awful Massachusetts.
Well, now, wait a minute.
Mechanic...
I mean, Massachusetts, you can't totally denigrate Massachusetts.
The whole state's bad.
All right. Well, anyway, go ahead. No names, please,
of
mechanics.
I hate driving there.
All right, go ahead, man.
So are you seeing these fuel injection problems that my mechanic and my stepdaughter's father-in-law says he's seen four or five with Honda?
What year is the car?
It was a 2018 Accord.
So,
and I'm told that they've seen them with not just Accord, Civics and CRVs, and you know, these guys are like, yeah, there's a problem with the fuel injection, and they wouldn't.
Well,
cover
I don't know
it.
If
I spent.
Yeah, I don't know if Honda is having mass problems. I see all kinds of makes and models. A lot of your vehicle engines now are called or using a direct injection system, GDI, and it's much higher pressure. It's a little bit more expensive of the components, and you can run into some big repair bills. I'm not seeing them falling apart in big numbers, but I'm not a unique Honda source, so I can't tell you, you know, in my world if that's the case out there. The CVT transmissions, they have a pretty high failure rate among most vehicles because of their design. I thought Hondas were holding up quite well, but Nissan had a real, real problem with them.
Huh.
Some of the other car makers had such problems when they stopped using them, and then some came back and others didn't. But yes, no, CVTs can be big trouble, and you don't fix them. You just replace the unit, and it can be very expensive.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry, Harlan.
I mean, I knew about the Nissans, but that's why I went with a Honda way back when.
Oh,
and you know,
well, the
because,
Honda had
you know,
a better
Nissan's
has a better track record with the CVTs, but I think you know you drive them all long enough, and they're all going to fail sooner or later.
All right, Harlan, thanks a lot, and I'm sure Harlan apologizes to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts for anything
the whole
he may
state.
Have said.
Yep.
That's, John in Belchertown. John, you're on.
Yes, Gordon, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Gordon, yeah, okay, I have a 2009 Chevy Silverado with 93,000 miles. When I'm driving 40, 50, 60 miles an hour, the engine light will come engine losing power, and it slows right down to about 20 miles an hour, and I have to pull over, and I'll shut it off for 5-10 minutes, and I'll start it back up, and it'll be perfect. It won't do it again for another month or so. And I've been to several mechanics, and they can't find out what the problem is.
Oy.
I had two MAP sensors replaced, and some other stuff they replaced too.
So did you say that when that happens, your check engine light starts flashing?
No, it doesn't flash. It comes right on.
The check engine light?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, like I said, I can wait 5-10 minutes and I can start it right up.
If I knew the code that the mechanics were scanning when that happened, I could be a little more specific, but you know the code is critical, and those codes stay in the computer. There's history codes that stay in there a long time. So I'm wondering if they were getting MAP sensor codes, and that's why they replaced them those few times. But unfortunately, that type of a problem has to be reproducible, and if it only happens once every couple of months. I know how frustrating it is. It's just as bad on me than it is on you, because when I get a vehicle like that, it may run like a top for an hour, and I'm frustrated because I can't solve the problem because it never reproduced itself, and if there's no codes in the computer's history, we don't even know where it thought the problem was.
Yeah.
So that's a tough one.
It's beautiful, you know. Okay, so I have to wait for it to come up again on a cold then.
And somebody's got to get there, and you know you got to get it to a shop fairly quickly. and get it scanned and just see what there was for a code, and that will be the evidence of where the problem is. It won't be the diagnosis, but it gets the mechanic in the right direction.
Gordon, if John were to buy one of those relatively inexpensive code readers at an auto parts store, would it be advanced enough for him to get that type of code?
Oh, it'll read any any engine code. So if the check engine light was illuminated, that code reader will give the code. It may not give a full description if it's a manufacturer specific, but it'll give the code.
All right, John.
Might be a good idea. I know what you're saying, Ray. Go buy one for $39.99.
Yeah, or something like that.
And be ready with it and plug it in when the problem occurs.
Yeah, I've used mine very often. It's a handy thing. At least you know what you're talking about when you go in, or at least part of it when you go into the mechanic. Phil in South Hadley, you only have about a minute here. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. Very quick question. I have a 2019 Toyota Highlander with 90,000 miles on it. Runs like a top. I want to hang out of this vehicle as long as I can. With 90K on it, Gordon, is there anything that you would recommend to set up for preventive maintenance, transmission fluid, what have you?
Yeah.
To maintain that on a regular basis, oil changes and all.
Yeah. It's a good vehicle. It'll go long distance for sure. My recommendation is not to follow the manufacturer's oil change intervals. I would do more like 5,000 per change. Maybe that's roughly what you've been doing. And that saves you from anguish when the engine reaches high mileage with variable valve timing components and timing chain wear and all that stuff. See what Toyota says in your manual about transmission fluid, because it is advisable to change that fluid, and there may be maintenance intervals on your vehicle for rear differential fluid. Other than that, all your maintenance should just be kept up to date, filters and all the things that are due. And I recommend a good gasoline additive about every oil change to keep your fuel injectors and your pistons clean.
All right, Phil, that's it. We'll have to leave it there. Very quickly, a couple emails here. See if you can blast those through. Matt writes, what's the best way to measure the depth of tire treads? I have no luck with the penny or quarter technique. Is there some kind of gadget with some accuracy that I can use? And that's from Matt.
Yeah, just go to any auto parts store and buy a tire tread depth gauge. And they make some nice ones where the scale is in colors, which just alerts you that, you know, like green is great.
Yep.
And then they've got a region that is like amber, kind of like a stoplight, meaning you're getting worn, but you're still okay. And then when you hit the red zone, you're in big trouble. So get one of those. Get a good one with the colors in it.
Tires are so expensive now. It's an instant fail if the treads aren't high enough. Yep.
230 seconds is passing. Anything below that, and believe me, 230 seconds is nothing you want to be doing on any big trips or travel. It's bare minimum.
Hey, Gordon, we're out of time here, but thank you, my friend. We'll see you next month.
That's great. Hopefully I'll be there live next time.
That would be nice. You were very much alive today, but hopefully we'll see you in person. All right, buddy. Good
Thank
luck.
You.
We'll talk to you. Support comes from the Albany Pine Bush Discovery Center, presenting October programs featuring howl prowls, autumn walks, watercolor painting, and photography workshops, albanypinebush.org. Capital Region Classical at Union College, opening its season with Baroque Ensemble, The Sebastians, featuring Bach's 4th Brandenburg Concerto, Sunday, October 13th, 3 p.m., capitalregionclassical.org. Add the VNA and Hospice of the Southwest Region, providing home health and hospice care since 1946 throughout Bennington, Franklin, and Rutland counties, vermontvisitingnurses.org. Once again, thanks to Gordon Fricke for being here. Thank you for calling. Terrific calls, terrific emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Ed Rosen screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Oh, this is exciting. Tomorrow, it's another thrill-packed episode of the Copyright Forum. Nail-biting intellectual property excitement tomorrow at 2:00.